Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Christopher Sorrentino, the author of a new novel, Trance, from Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. He's the author, as well, of a novel, his first, Sound on Sound, that was published by Dalkey Archive Press. Now, Trance takes as its occasion the story of a kidnapped American heiress who we have come to know as Patricia Hearst, and reorchestrates and re-represents that story. There's an author's note at the end that puts it very well, and I'm going to read part of that note. Fiction based on real events always risks appearing to be coy about its proximity to the actual, whether or not its author hews closely to the facts. Still, I thought in this case it might be of use to affirm that while many of the situations this novel depicts and the people it portrays are drawn from a well-documented episode in recent American history, I have disregarded the record whenever it served my purpose to do so. Now, I wanted to ask you about that purpose.
I think my purpose largely was to take a hugely famous moment in American history and have a lot of fun with it. Once I started looking at the case, after I decided that it might make good material for a novel, I was really drawn in, not only by the overwhelming kookiness of the SLA, but by how it all played out against a really strangely turbulent backdrop. America was going through an energy crisis. White flight had seemingly, I guess, hit its apogee. Nixon's White House was disintegrating by the day. Vietnam, the fighting was over, but we were watching it slip away, as we probably could have predicted it would much earlier than it actually happened. And this strange group of, I guess, unsympathetically quixotic revolutionaries were stalking the countryside, prattling on about the fascist insect of American government and American society, and how they were going to, through some unspecified means, make it all better.
Now, Sound on Sound, your previous novel, takes place on the evening of Reagan's inauguration, and this one occupies the end of the Nixon administration. Are these political novels, do you feel?
I didn't really consider Trance to be a novel with politics at the forefront. Sound on Sound, I think, had a more blatant political bent. I really used the device of Reagan's inauguration as a way of saying that the events that happen in Sound on Sound, which takes place essentially over the course of a single evening, foreshadow what Reagan's presidency would oversee as far as American culture and society was concerned. To me, especially when I was writing Sound on Sound, it seemed to me that the 80s represented some really ugly undercurrents that have always been, or at least throughout my lifetime, in American society. And that sort of greed and venality and superficial worship of the transient kind of took the forefront during that time in ways that I found really unpleasant, that in retrospect in some ways look more harmless than they looked at the time. But there were still pretty oppressive. I mean, if you were a person of a certain frame of mind, as I was, I guess a movie like, say, Top Gun could actually be intimidating.
Well, because it seems to me that these two novels, both of them, Sound on Sound and Trance, by my guest Christopher Sorrentino, are about what happens in a certain way when a new kind of thinking or pseudo-thinking comes to the fore and people have got to find language to account for all these new manifestations. So frequently they're inventing by the seat of their pants. They're moving forward with full cloth invention as reality passes them by. So the SLA really is six or eight people who are pretending, in fact, to be an army with a revolutionary ethic and plans, when in fact there is no ethic. There are slogans, you know. And that the comedy here comes about in both books with people trying to talk a language that will make sense to others in the same situation but is not likely to outlast the immediate occasion for the invention of that language.
No, not at all. I mean, you've kind of put your finger on it. I mean, Trance is about the SLA and their solipsistic outlook, but the people in Sound on Sound, which concerns a rock band, are no less self-involved or blind to what's going on around them. I mean, they too are middle-class folks who have become enchanted by the rebellious posturing that rock and roll seems to promise them, and at the same time are infatuated with the idea of becoming famous and wealthy and accepting the bounty of American society. And that too with the SLA. They wanted to overthrow the American government, but by the same token they were incredibly interested in making a book deal and in getting a six-figure advance for this book. And part of one of the running episodes in Trance is their attempt to put together a book that kind of encompasses all of their wacky, dogmatic ideas while at the same time appealing to Random House or Doubleday or another huge company.
For instance, one of the things that happens is that the SLA arrives at a house in East L.A. where two single mothers are cohabiting in the wake of their disappointments in boyfriends and marriage. And what plays out is a kind of set piece, and what it is like, terrifyingly and hilariously, is an episode of an evening sitcom with a black family being invaded by the Symbionese Liberation Army and wondering, are we going to have enough food? And who are these people? And what are these guns doing messing up my kitchen? And neighbors dropping by and saying, who are they? And the white kids trying to invent a kind of gratitude politesse toward their hosts. In other words, seen from a distance, the things enter a realm that can only be understood through media, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think so. That may have more to do with the specific way that a novel can frame actual events. I mean, in that case, I was actually hewing pretty close to the chronology and to the facts of what happened. But my tendency as a writer was to exaggerate the more outlandish aspects of it. I mean... When you present it as a premise the way you just have, it does look very much like a situation comedy or perhaps a light show on that might run on Broadway. You know, the SLA drops in and lessons are learned and allegiances are formed and
everyone's life has changed.
Everyone's life has changed. Of course, in real life, what happened after all the comedy, inadvertent or invented and otherwise, was the Los Angeles police surrounded the house and got into a firefight with the SLA, which foolishly fired back, or I think they actually initiated the firing and then set it on fire and burned them all to death, the ones that they hadn't shot.
Now, these kinds of distortions occur throughout the book. There's a point at which the sports writer who's writing about the treatment of black athletes as an aspect of the necessary revolution, who existed, in fact, who is looking for the six-figure deal and wants to be giving exclusives with, in this case, Alice Galton, he visits a psychic, and his question to her is, what chemical additives not yet discovered have I eaten over the course of a lifetime that will harm my future? And she announces the litany of unfortunate chemical additives that will, in fact, eventually give him a stroke. But that's the kind of thing that comes to a height two-thirds of the way through the book, in which from a rumor that the SLA were now working at Grossinger's, while Tanya is serving and promising people that there won't be too much fat on their pastrami, a humorist is doing his Richard Nixon impressions and interpretations more like Lenny Bruce in his way than the audience wants him to be. And the whole sense always of life having become entirely anomalous, anomaly generating more anomaly, seems to be the sense of this book.
Well, life is becoming anomalous within a literary context. I mean, I see my own work as always being literary first and reflective of actual life, maybe fourth or tenth or something. I saw the potential for the absurd in all of the true events and was able to extrapolate from the true events, I guess, very literary pseudo-events that would keep me entertained and hopefully keep readers of the book entertained more than a more documentary style or approach. I mean, when I started writing Trance, my sense was that it would be much more schematic, that it would follow the events much more closely, that it would be a smaller book, that it would be a quicker book. And then something happened. You know, the book got very interesting to me. You know, when a writer starts playing around with his or her materials, then, you know, wonderful things can happen, at least for the person who's sitting there at the desk every single day. And I think for readers who are going along with that, wonderful things happen for them as well. I mean, this book was a lot of fun for me to write.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. And today, my guest is Christopher Sorrentino. We're here in the studios of KCRW. Chris Sorrentino is the author, most recently, of Trance, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Christopher Sorrentino about his novel, Trance. Now, I wanted to announce a kind of, I don't know if you would call it a hidden subject, but certainly something that I thought about when I was reading Trance. Chris Sorrentino is the son of a writer who has been on the show, I think, 3 or 4 times. That's Gilbert Sorrentino. He's one of the writers who is devoted to the idea of a novel being a work of art, and the definition of that work of art being almost as a given its uselessness in the face of life, that it has its own order of rules, its own ways of working, that these ways of working aren't in the service of anything, including life-likeness or chronology. And in fact, there is here a statement of life and art as being indifferent to one another, that art is useless in that sense. Now, since Trance talks about one of those places that most people point to, a generation gap between the Hursts and their daughter, and it is Mrs. Hurst, or Mrs. Galton in this book, who gives something like a summative statement and uses the word trance, the title word. Right. She seems to be the first person in the book, and it's around 30 or 40 pages before its conclusion, who's talking a kind of sense. You know, are you all crazy? Why are you giving in to everything? Why are you being so weak? Why are you compromising your values? Why are you accepting this daughter who has become a criminal as someone you want to rescue at all costs? Why are you giving up your values? Even if they're values that can be contradicted, they are yours. I mean, she seems like the voice of sense in this novel.
She's the only character in the book. I ended up loving Lydia a lot. She's the only character in the entire book who is absolutely single-minded. She knows who she is. She knows what she cares about. She knows, she's well aware of when she's making concessions to life and to, you know, social graces. And she doesn't necessarily like it, but she doesn't fool herself. And, you know, I'm usually attracted to characters or to voices like that. And when I started writing her, you know, I think the earlier incarnations of her, the earlier drafts, showed her to be a kind of caricature. You know, she was really shrewish. And as I got into the book, she got more nuanced. Turned out she had a lot of stuff going on that you might not have been able to detect from earlier parts of the book. And by the time she does get to that summation, she's really kind of step forward to become almost a guiding voice. I mean, that is actually, I think, one of maybe two, maybe it's the only first-person sections of the book. Most of the book is narrated from a third-person kind of omniscient perspective. And in that case, I really wanted her to address both her husband, who's putatively the person she's speaking with, and the audience, the readers, directly.
Well, what I'm trying to suggest here is that just as, you know, at the time, she was the last figure in the historical rendering of the story that people would have sympathy for. You know, they were the pigs. and she has an incredible presence here. It's almost as if she's been biding her time working out anagrams for antidepressants. I think diazepam is where she begins.
Valium, that is.
Yeah. And she, but she seems to be the sensible voice of a previous generation, just as Gilbert seems to be the voice of a generation for this novel that's going to ask for values that are true for themselves, to themselves, that a book be of its own making, that it not be about something, but about the artist's acts of choice within it. In other words, you are continuing a revolution in the novel that your father was a part of, and that you're a happy participant.
I've never really seen any reason to oppose my father's aesthetic, or his multiple aesthetics. I mean, it always made absolutely perfect sense to me what he was talking about, what he was doing, and the way his novels turned out. And, you know, I often hear others speaking of my dad's work and of the work of writers like him. And it seems to me that they're talking about entirely different books than the ones that I know and am familiar with. I mean, they don't strike me as difficult. They don't strike me as affectless. They don't strike me as self-indulgent. They don't strike me as being cold or heartless. They don't strike me as being books that somehow fly in the face of some God-given definition of what literature ought to be, which somehow seems to always coincide with the definition of literature by the dumbest and most narrow-minded of book reviewers. I am a happy participant in that revolution. I do hope to carry it forward throughout the rest of my writing life. Anyway, I always want to try and make things different. I've always have wanted to try and do things differently. It seems to me that that's a great place for a writer who's just starting out to have his or her head. Even if it's a high school idea of difference, like the stuff I first was enchanted with, you know, Burroughs and Kathy Acker and stuff that just blew my mind when I was in my early 20s, you want to do something that is going to advance what the narrative can do. Mm-hmm. You don't want to just plod ahead. And it strikes me as being directly opposite of what a lot of other young writers who I read or who I hear of seem to be saying, which is, I don't want to be different at all. I want to be the same. I want what I do to look like what other people do. I want it to read like what other people do. I basically want it to be seamless and part of the fiction generating machine of America. And that's not, you know, I'm not pretending that I'm a particularly innovative writer, but I always try to keep things interesting. And if you're not doing that, then you might as well go to law school or something.
Well, you see, that's why, follow me closely here, because I did find myself midway through Trans saying, okay, what is the stake? What is the inner stake that this writer, Christopher Sorrentino, has in this material? Okay? To my mind, we're dealing with the story of a woman who is leaving to join a revolution to overthrow the complacencies of life, so-called. By doing that, she has to enter a world of solipsism, of terrorism, of so-called brainwashing. But whatever she does, she's entered, it's useful to call her Alice in this book, she's entered a wonderland of complete reinvention of American life. And she is in rebellion against her parents, her famous parents, the representatives of reality, the purveyor of newspapers, the purveyor of American naturalism.
A kind of reality.
A kind of reality of what Americans accept as reality, reportage. And I thought, oh, I think I have it here. Because, you know, Christopher Sorrentino, son of one of the writers I most admire working today, is in this situation. How do you rebel against the father when the father is already a revolutionary? Do you see what I mean?
I do.
That the book is, you know, so that this book that is about the most famous war against the previous generation publicly waged is a kind of answer that says, you know, we don't have to be always inverting values and thought. Sometimes there are things to be maintained. I happen to be a writer who can be the next in a generation of writers who rebel against the everyday nature of narrative, that my work is a part of that rebellion.
It's not necessarily a rebellion. It's really a linked tradition that you see going back for a long, long time. The idea that this is somehow a really disruptive thorn in the side of some pale and flaccid literary body that gives us this kind of pap that we see all over the place is propaganda. And I am part of the tradition. I am not, you know, I'm not trying to rebel against anything except this kind of complacent idea about what fiction needs to be. One thing that I think tends to separate me and a lot of the writers around my age who I admire from my dad and all the writers around his age is I think that anxiety of influence, that sense, well, how do we reverentially overthrow Joyce and Faulkner and Beckett? I don't think that's there at all. I think when you are reading David Foster Wallace or reading, I don't know, anybody at all who's doing really interesting work, they are availing themselves of their literary fathers with aplomb and with no fear. I think we are really happy to plunder the work of a DeLillo, of a Gaddis, of a Coover, and there's no sense of deference, and I don't think there's any sense of trying to get past it. I mean, you want to extend it, but mm-hmm. you don't want to cast it out of your work.
I've been talking with Christopher Sorrentino, author most recently of Trance, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Thank you for joining me, Chris.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.